since I moved onto the sidewalk for my art, I find it much harder to draw on a piece of paper because the friends that I draw on a piece of paper are in a strange kind of jail made out of the edges of that piece of paper. They don't really exist in the same space that I do. But as soon as you draw something on the sidewalk, it is part of the real world. It can stretch on as far as it needs to. If you had enough sidewalk, you could draw a life-size whale, and it would be part of your world now. And they have much more reality when they're actually sitting on the sidewalk next to you. And that gives them much more power to change my day. And since they stick around after I walk away, I've noticed they tend to change other people's bad days as well.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast, the podcast in which I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. The timing of today's episode is really neat because on last episode, I had abstract painter Maya Resnick on the show. Well, today my guest is also an artist, but one who works in a completely different medium and who has a completely different perspective of how he creates art and tells stories. And this is one of the joys of getting to dig deep with these long-form interviews, is the chance to learn about the profound diversity in philosophy and process that make up the foundation of these incredible creations and stories. So my guest today is David Zinn. David Zinn lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more than 20 years, he freelanced for a wide variety of commercial clients, but now, thanks to the temptations of a box of sidewalk chalk on an unusually sunny day in Michigan, David is known all over the world for the art he creates on the street. David's temporary street drawings are composed entirely out of chalk, charcoal, and found objects, and are always improvised on location through a process known as, let me see if I can pronounce this right, pareidolic anamorphosis. And we dig into that more in the show, but the only thing you really need to know right now is that it's a process where his illustrations really look like they're popping out into the real world. They're three-dimensional. It's really trippy. Most of his creatures appear on sidewalks in Michigan, but many have surfaced as far away as subway platforms in Manhattan, village squares in Sweden, and street corners in Taiwan. David has achieved global notoriety through sharing his artwork on his Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages. He is often the person I tell my friends about as my favorite Instagram follow. At the top of the show notes, I have actually included a link to his Instagram page, and I highly suggest, if you haven't seen his artwork, clicking on over there real quick to just see the art before listening to the episode. Just might give you a little bit more context. In this episode, David and I talk about how he makes a living drawing tiny monsters on the sidewalk out of chalk, why he loves the ephemerality of an art form that disappears after it rains, and his advice for people who are searching to find their own creative voice. I hope you enjoy my conversation with David Zinn. David Zinn, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. I have been a huge fan of your work for a long time now, and it's excited to talk with you and to see you over Skype today.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
The cat excited too. Hey.
what kind of cat do you have?
He's a cow cat. He sleeps all day, but he apparently is aware that you're talking, and so he wants to do everything he can to, he's a cat. It's his job.
So where are you coming to us from today?
Ann Arbor, Michigan, the place where I was born and mostly raised.
Cool.
Well, pretty much.
Nice. So over email, when we were organizing this interview, you were telling me, we were kind of trying to figure out when to do this interview, and you mentioned that springtime coming up was about to be a pretty busy time for street artists. And that kind of got me thinking and interested in what is this time of year like for a street artist when the weather starts to get warm, the sun starts to come out? And just in general, like, what is the yearly schedule for a street artist?
That's a very good question, in that it doesn't apply to a lot of street artists, I think, as it does to me. In fact, I think I may be an anomaly among street artists in living in a part of the country where it's too cold to draw outside for at least half the year. Most of the other street artists I've met, they live in Florida, they live in Texas, they live in places where they can do this year round. which makes me surprised that they ever started, because one of the main reasons that I was able to excuse doing this as an art form was the fact that nice days in Michigan are few and far between. And because we get all the different kinds of weather and therefore very little of any one kind of weather, if there's a beautiful day in Michigan, you think of any excuse to take advantage of it. Any reason to be outside is well worth it, because otherwise, you know, you miss a chance. And so this is the time of year where I've conveniently forgotten there is such a thing as temperatures above freezing or going outside without a scarf, which is one of the reasons why I've lived here my whole life. I like that rediscovery every season, like it's a miracle. I mean, if the seasons change, you really can be surprised by something that other people take for granted, which in this case is having the weather get warm enough that I can go crawl around on the sidewalk for 4 hours without freezing to death, which is nice.
So for you, is your schedule like springtime hits and you're outside through like the end of summer into, I live in California, so my weather all right. Radar is a little, it's a little off.
Well, that makes sense. Well, actually, there hasn't been a really predictable rhythm yet. I've only been doing this as my primary job for maybe 5-7 years. And I do a lot of work around here just on a whim, but I'm also starting to get hired to go to other parts of the world to draw, which would logically spread it out over the whole calendars, because there's always some place where it's warm enough to draw outside. I was in Laguna Beach just a few weeks ago at a time when it was still very gray and cold here. And it was, you know, definitely a good place to draw, Southern California. I can see the temptation. But it does, since most of my work is unplanned, I do some commission work and I go to festivals and I do workshops with kids. But I also draw still most of the time just as an excuse to be outside. So in that sense, you're right. It starts when the weather gets warm enough. At this time of year, 45 degrees suddenly seems like a really nice day. And in 2 months, it'll seem like a really cold day. So I just grab the chalk and run while I can. Yeah.
So what did you do, for example, this past winter? What was your, what were you doing?
It was a combination of really desperately needed housework. Because, you know, it's a good way to avoid housework, drawing outside. And a few bits of traveling work to places where it was warm enough. And also a lot of drawing on bar coasters. Because there are so many months of the year that I can't do this on the ground, I found stand-ins for the ephemerality of drawing on the ground, because even though it's one of the things people think is saddest about drawing something temporary on the sidewalk with chalk, the fact that it gets destroyed is a big part of the comfort of doing it. It has no future, and the future is usually more of a source of worry than joy. I think with everything, it's my art. So knowing it's only going to last for now is a good way to just enjoy making it without worrying about its practicality or its quality or its usefulness, or, you know, are you going to sell it? Anyway. And so the best indoor version of that I've found is to draw on napkins and bar coasters and concrete, you know, countertops where someone's going to come wipe it down with a rag pretty soon. And so a lot of local bartenders have had to stand in for Mother Nature force for my art. So there's been a lot of that.
I'd love to follow up on that just a little bit in this ephemerality. And I'm wondering if you had an experience early on in your career or a moment you felt comfort in that ephemerality. And I'm curious because with art or even, you know, the documentary films I make, I consider them art, and there's so much that excites me about saying, I'm going to create something that lasts, that you'll be able to revisit on the internet or wherever it lives anytime you want. And there's something exciting to me about that. And I'm wondering from your experience where you're coming from.
Well, it's a valid point that as a documentary filmmaker, you and I are standing at opposite ends of the spectrum in that respect, because one of the main points of your art is to preserve. That's, I imagine, I'm speaking for you, but I imagine that's a big motivator for documenting things. And in theory, art should be the same way. But I think it wasn't so much discovering a love for ephemerality for me as it was eventually finding an escape from a fear of permanence. Because I'd never really considered myself an artist. I still don't, frankly. But certainly growing up and as a young person, art is a very high imagined thing. It's something that's only done by very special people with very special skills, using very special and usually expensive materials. And we see it as something that is very serious and is only done by people who know what they're doing. Which, for someone like me, is a good way to make sure I never do it, because I clearly don't know what I'm doing now. I'm probably never going to be serious enough to make art, so maybe I should just walk away, you know. And that was part of the problem. If you have a piece of blank canvas all stretched, either through, you know, money or time spent making it a perfectly blank white canvas, and you've got all of your paints lined up in a perfect row, all ready to go, now you have to get over that hump of starting on changing that blank canvas into something which is better than it's being blank in the first place. And the obstruction I ran into was I didn't have any ideas good enough to claim that they were better than that canvas just remaining blank. Because you have to have important idea. I have to have a great idea for great art before I start messing with this canvas. Because as soon as I mess with this canvas, I got to do something with it. That's where the permanence was a problem. Because as soon as you finish painting a canvas, you have to deal with it. You have to try to sell it, or you have to frame it. You have to give it away. You have to give it to your mom. You have to put it in your attic, and eventually your attic is full, and then you got to take it in the backyard and set fire to it. None of these are the fun part of making art. That's where the permanence is not preferable to me, because I would rather just do the fun part, which is the making of the art. And what I try to make people understand, just in case it works for them too, but at least so they can understand why I do this insane thing that I do, is that by drawing something that is ephemeral and self-destructing, I don't have to waste time on the framing and the shipping and the selling and the giving away and the putting, because I can't. And so all that time instead is spent making more art. And luckily, since I started doing this after social media and the internet took over our lives, it hasn't really hurt the sharing of my art at all. In fact, it could be argued that more people are exposed to the photograph of the self-destructing drawing that I put on the internet than would have ever seen the original piece of art in the first place.
Well, I'd love to return to that idea of how you use social media, because I'm really interested in that. And you've built a pretty large following on Facebook and Instagram and all that. So we'll return to that. But I think now it'd be useful to get a little bit of background into your arc as an artist, if you'll allow me to call you that for a moment. So how did you get your start, and what kind of art have you been doing up until this period 5 or 7 years ago when street art became your focus?
Well, it started out as just doodling. In fact, the starting out, I think, is an odd conversation I've had with a lot of people on the street. Since when you make art in public, you have a lot of conversations about art in public, which is one of the things I like about it. And a lot of people want to know when I started drawing, as if that makes a difference. It's the strangest question I've had to answer, in part because I think I take it as a question and it's not really meant as a serious question. It's just a weird kind of backhanded compliment. But people want to, like, when did you start drawing? As if that's the key to everything, that I started like 6 months before they ever did. When the truth of it is, and it took me a while to figure this out, I started drawing at the exact same age that you started drawing. Because we all of us had this awkward, uneventful time in our lives when we knew how to hold a crayon and we didn't know how to write. and there was nothing else to do with your time except make marks on stuff. And so that was when I started growing up before video games and before the internet, just making doodles on everything. Just like everyone else did. And so the real question is, why didn't I stop? Because most people stop. They find other things to do with their time. And I kept going to the present day. I think that's partially based on my parents, who, depending on whether I want to cast them as the heroes or the villains, they either wanted to encourage me or they liked the peace and quiet. You know, they had a perfect parenting trick that if they ever wanted my brother and I to be quiet, all they needed was two pieces of paper and two pencils. And they wouldn't hear a peep out of us for hours. As long as there was more paper, they were fine. So that, I think, helped keep me as a doodler all the way to the point where I realized it's a fantastic defense mechanism for a shy person. Because I was extremely shy as a kid and as a teenager and still now. And I realized early on the best way to avoid a conversation is to not make eye contact. And staring at the ground is very strange. Staring at a thing that you're drawing is still strange, but it's a little bit more appropriately strange. And so I never left the house without something to draw on and something to draw with. And it was through doing that, ironically, though I was doing that as a way to avoid human contact, it was doodling in public that got me my first jobs. Because I live in a small enough town that there's people who need a guy who likes to draw stuff. And I was there in plain sight drawing stuff. So when the first people showed up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, could you draw this for me? It was hard to claim that I didn't do that because I was at that time doing that.
And at that time, were you drawing on a notebook or were you drawing on the street already at that age?
Oh, no. It was scraps of paper at the time, but preferably the way it does relate logically to sidewalks, it was ideally scrap paper. It was placemats in restaurants, and it was napkins, and it was the corners of my homework. When I got my first job, I was actually drawing on the very boring cover of the textbook that we were using in the room full of people I was trying to avoid contact with. And we were working on a project that needed some promotional materials. And one of the more outgoing people actually asked me if I would draw promotional materials for this project we were doing. And when I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that, they pointed out that I was currently drawing something that they could use right there on the front of the. And they actually asked, could we just use that? And it's hard to say, like, no, I can't. Okay. So, yeah, it was meant to be completely useless and disposable. But, you know, the way it works out, people see value in things you don't value yourself. And that led to the first commercial job, which is how I avoided blank canvases for the next 20 years, was only drawing things that I'd been asked to draw or on scraps of paper, so that there was never that fear. And to readdress the fear of making art on a blank canvas, that it's having that freedom of the blankness, that you could create anything on a piece of canvas, which is too many choices, it's too many opportunities, which actually make it really hard to narrow down on what it is you want to make, because it could be anything. And if it could be anything, that means there's probably one perfect thing you could create. And if there could be one perfect thing to create, that means everything except that perfect thing would be a failure. At least that's how my brain worked at the time. And so not having that freedom to create anything, and instead having an assignment, having a request, having a specific problem to solve with art, is much easier to face. If you have a fear of that freedom of a completely blank canvas like I do, one of the best ways to avoid it is to have someone come to you and say, okay, we're putting on a Shakespeare play, we're putting it on the moon, all with spacesuits, and we're worried people are going to be upset when they get there that it's in space. So we have to have a poster that makes it clear what it is we're doing. And now you have a story problem. You have a problem to solve. And that's much easier to deal with, I found. So that helped for a long time. Just keeping me drawing stuff without feeling like I was making art. Because when you're drawing a little diagram that shows people what garbage they're supposed to throw in the garbage can and which stuff they're supposed to throw in the recycle bin, that doesn't feel like art in a good way. Because now that it's obviously not art, you're free to play around with all the parts of it that are fun. You know, you can make up your own little brands of cereal, little chaff wads going into the garbage can, which is a good way to tap in, I think, to the inner child part that used to scribble on everything, which I think every artist is trying to reconnect with that tiny version of ourselves that didn't know how to write yet and just wanted to make marks on the world, because that's the first creative power you have, to not leave the world the way you found it, because now you can make marks on it, which is huge as power. And I just want to maintain that feeling with a minimum of the self-doubt that we get when we grow older than the age of 5.
And so how did you make the move from working commercial jobs with clients to then doing the sidewalk art?
Right. That was a strange transition, because I spent 20 years trying very hard to make myself useful to society by doing commercial work and drawing diagrams for the city and Shakespeare posters, and would have been very happy continuing to do that if it wasn't for the fact that all of that work had started to be done in a computer. So instead of rubber cement and knives and things, it was now tapping away to keyboard and scribbling with a mouse, which didn't get that same feeling of getting your hands dirty. And the computer was inside. And then, like I said, Michigan, we only have so many beautiful days. And if you're self-employed, like I was, and working at home, it's really hard to ignore a beautiful day. And so eventually I needed any rationalization. You know, I obviously couldn't just go sit in the hammock and drink a beer because I was working. You know, it takes a lot of discipline to be your own boss and be self-employed. But it can't just be all sticks. There has to be a carrot every once in a while. So part of being your own boss is being the kind of boss that says, you know what you maybe need? You maybe need to go outside for a little while and do some brainstorming. Yeah, we're just going to clear our heads, just relax, we're just going to mess around with some chalk on the sidewalk, and maybe that'll give us a breakthrough that we can then go back inside and go back to work on the boring thing that we had to do. And that's honestly how it started. I just wanted any excuse to be outside on a nice day. And because I'm an artist, technically anytime I'm making any kind of art anywhere, I'm technically doing my job. Which was a terrible, irresponsible rationalization and the most important decision I ever made in my life. Because as it turns out, the world was much more interested in me making art that just made me happy and had no reason to exist than 20 years worth of trying to make myself useful.
Why do you think that is?
I try not to think about it too much, actually, because it doesn't really make sense to my inner sense of duty to the human race. Although it suggests that there's a value to the pointlessness of art, which I think does get into the storytelling aspect of art, that as much as I feel a little bit guilty that I'm not out there digging ditches in troubled places or trying to cure cancer, it's clear if you look at how the human species works that we're not like ants. Maybe I shouldn't malign ants. Ants might too. But when we have a problem to solve, we don't solve it just by taking practical steps to solve it. Some of us will, you know, there'll always be some people who think about the problem very seriously and directly and come up with solutions to that problem. But there's always this separate chunk of us who write songs about the problem or paint paintings of the problem, which logically isn't helping at all. And yet, I think I can argue that it's because we approach our problems that way that we've solved so many of them. and have become such a successful species on this planet, because we come up with weird solutions by using impractical thoughts to solve them. The best example I can think of, though this isn't necessarily a problem that needed to be solved, but it's clear that we as a species for a long time have wanted to be able to fly. Something we saw other animals doing, we really wanted to do it ourselves, it really bugged us that we couldn't do it. And I'm pretty fairly certain that the first human being to conceive of human beings being able to fly was not a scientist. He was honestly probably the local crazy guy who had weird dreams and then told people about them. Like, I had this amazing dream where I could like fly and I had wings and stuff. And so first there was him, and they probably laughed at him or kicked him out of town or something like that. And then there were the people who actually wrote some stories about being able to fly and some mythology about being able to fly and maybe some paintings and some songs and some actual visualizations on paper and on canvas of what flying would be. And then you get several generations of that, and eventually that trickles down into the brain of somebody with the smarts to make it happen. But they didn't start it. They had to have that art trickle into their head and have a moment of thinking, wait a minute, that actually could be done. And that's where it moves into the scientific and the practical. But it almost never starts there. I don't think it does. It starts with our fears and our desires. And that's art.
Do you feel like your art addresses a problem? And if so, what problem do you feel like it addresses?
Being completely honest, the problem it addresses usually is I'm not having a very nice day. And the solution it gives is that I create what I think reality failed to provide for me. It's very selfish. You know, I wish I had imaginary friends waving at me as I'm walking down the street. So if I don't see them, I make them, and then I can see them. In fact, since I started doing that, since I moved onto the sidewalk for my art, I find it much harder to draw on a piece of paper, because the friends that I draw on a piece of paper are in a strange kind of jail made out of the edges of that piece of paper. They don't really exist in the same space that I do. But as soon as you draw something on the sidewalk, it is part of the real world. It can stretch on as far as it needs to. If you had enough sidewalk, you could draw a life-size whale, and it would be part of your world now. And they have much more reality when they're actually sitting on the sidewalk next to you. And that gives them much more power to change, well, to change my day. And since they stick around after I walk away, I've noticed they tend to change other people's bad days as well. So.
And I would add on top of that, unfortunately, I've never seen your artwork in person, but just in the way that I see it on social media, I think that another problem it could probably solve for people is this problem that a lot of people have with not being present. And what I, you know, when I see your artwork, oftentimes the first thing that pops up, I'm trying to see what you used in the environment to bring your character to life, whether it was like a little tuft of grass that came out of the sidewalk, or if it was a wall of bricks, or if it was some drainage pipe. And it's hard to not see that. And then when you go walk through the world, just a little bit more notice those details in the world. And I think that solves a problem that people have with being more present to their surroundings.
So glad to hear that. That's exactly what I hope will happen. That first of all, to notice them in real life takes a little open-mindedness. A lot of people who even live in my own neighborhood, where I've drawn hundreds of things, have complained to me that they've never seen one in real life because they're very small and they aren't jumping out at you. They literally can't do that. So the only way you can see them is if you happen to be looking in the right place at the right time. But I think even beyond that, your mind has to be open to seeing unexpected things. It's a frightening thing to realize how little of what we see, even with our eyes, is objectively what's there. because our brains are trying to save us time. Like, I think, I'm pretty sure I know what this is, so I'm just going to give you what I think is important. And so if you really know what you expect to see today, you're not going to notice anything that doesn't fit that model. And thank you for reminding me that my hope is, especially since it's a very big world and I can only draw on so much of it, that if you infect people's minds with this idea that there's more there than they are expecting to see, eventually they will see it for themselves. And they won't really need me anymore. I can make myself obsolete, where those creatures are already there. I just made them a little easier for you to see. And if I do my job right, you will see them even where I haven't drawn anything. That opens up, I think, a whole part of our brains that's important to have functioning, even and especially if you're not an artist by trade. Because it's seeing things that aren't really there, seeing the potential for things that aren't really there, that opens up that problem solving in other places that we were talking about.
No, I love that. So can you walk us through the process of creating these sidewalk art pieces? Like, what time are you leaving your house? What kind of gear are you bringing with you? What are you looking for? Just kind of bring us through a day and how you make these things.
Well, the method has evolved based on all the times that I wished I had the chalk with me and didn't. Because, you know, they are ideally done, even though I do them for official purposes for various people all over the world. Most of them are still done within walking distance of my house and on the way to somewhere I had to go. So it's a little frightening to realize that if someone geotagged every drawing I'd ever made, they would know not only exactly where I live, but also what route I take to walk downtown, because they just happen along the way. There are times when I'll go search out a new corner, but I haven't run out of possibilities, even on the 5-block walk between me and the main street of Ann Arbor. And it's been years. And even if some law was passed where I was not allowed to leave those 5 blocks, I would never run out of a place to draw, in part because there are places I've already drawn something 5 times, but it's rained 5 times, and so I can always do number 6. So the trick is just to be prepared. And I think I've heard murmurings from other artists, especially other writers, that they have this similar habit and mindset, that the trick is that when you have that really cool idea or that really great phrase and collection of words that pops into your head, the difference between me and a writer is the writer stops to make a note of it. They have a little notebook, they have something to type on, they're always ready to grab the thing that passes through instead of just letting it go. And so I carry a small box. I think it was originally meant for paintbrushes. I found it in the local office supply shop on the discount shelf because it had a crack in it. Had no idea what it was going to be for, but it just seemed like it wanted to come home with me. And it turns out to be exactly the right size for 4 rows of chalk. Little tiny chalks, big chalks, a little bit of charcoal, and it's light enough that I can carry it in one hand, and that's my whole art studio in one hand, that is easy enough to carry around that it never seems like a burden of like, well, I'm just going to the bank. I don't really need to take the chalk, do I? Like, no, you need the chalk. Because there was that other time when you were standing right outside the bank and you saw that one little manhole cover that really wanted to be something and you were helpless and you couldn't do anything about it. So it's being prepared, just like a writer would with a scrap of paper to write ideas on, that if nothing else, there's a matchbox somewhere on my person with a piece of charcoal in it, just in case. So I just walk around with those tools, you know, something to make the drawings with and some kind of camera to take the pictures with. And that's all I need, which is reassuring.
And I've also seen some videos where you have like some really long, it almost looks like a pointer tool, and you have a piece of chalk at the end of it.
Yeah.
What is that? Do you carry that often?
I carry that almost everywhere as well. I try not to get addicted to it because, you know, philosophically, it's very important to me to prove not only to myself, but to any, especially any kids who see me drawing in public, that the tools are as simple and easy to obtain as possible. A lot of the chalk in the chalk box actually says Crayola on the side. These are not fancy chalks. These are not fancy tools, which is why I don't have to worry about wasting them, because they're toys, the children's toys. But the reason I carry the chalk stick is that all of these drawings, well, most of these drawings are done with a certain visual trick to them. It's called anamorphosis, which is a distortion of a flat drawing that makes it look three-dimensional when seen from one perfect viewpoint. And that perfect viewpoint, ideally, is where someone else might be standing, so that they can see it look 3D as well. And early on, I had a little bit of a problem that I would see something in a tuft of grass or a pipe sticking out of the ground that I really wanted to draw, get down on my hands and knees, draw the hell out of it, and then realize it was going to look three-dimensional only to other people crawling on their hands and knees. Because that's where my eyes were at the time that I saw it and drew it. And that's frustrating, because the only people going to be crawling around the sidewalk on their hands and knees have other problems much bigger than seeing my little piece of art. So the chalk stick is designed to make it possible to at least draw some of the drawing from the same vantage point where it will be seen by other people. So it's like a bionic arm to add extra reach, so that I can stand at my normal height and actually draw on the ground at the same time. It also saves on the knees of my pants, because otherwise it's up and down and up and down and up and down.
Right.
Step back to look at it, get down on the ground to look at it, draw it. But it was very aerobic, but it was exhausting before the chalk.
So you walk around, you have your toolkit, very simple. You see something in the natural environment that sparks something in your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And then right there, you just like stop and start. And so with the chalk stick you were talking about, it looked like in the videos that I saw, you use that almost like as an outline.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get down into the details and bring out the different pieces of chalk. Is that correct?
Yeah, eventually, both for precision, but also just for the joy of getting your hands dirty. You got to get down there with your fingers and really get close to it. But the early part with the chalk stick, and even before the chalk stick, it's kind of like playing connect the dots. And it's a really easy version of connect the dots, because you are allowed to and encouraged to add more dots. There's a word for this. It's called pareidolia. And although no one else is using this term yet, so I guess I own it for the time being.
Patent pending, people.
Yeah, patent pending. I have described what I am doing at this point as augmented pareidolia. Pareidolia is a thing everyone's brain does. It's up there in your head right now. And it is our human tendency to see meaning in random stuff. Pareidolia is why we see a man in the moon. Pareidolia is almost certainly why our ancestors saw constellations in the stars. Because if you're spending a long, dark night staring at the sky trying not to get eaten by a tiger, those stars will start to look like something more than just stars, if only because you are so bored waiting for morning to come that you draw pictures in your head. And so the sidewalk is a perfect playground for pareidolia, because it is not a blank surface. There's always specks and cracks and, like you said, tufts of grass. But even beyond that, there's bits of random information that will start to look like something if you stare at it for any length of time. So the early part isn't so much a, oh my God, that's what, oh, big light bulb above my head. This is exactly what this needs to be. It's just a vague impression that looks a little bit like a nose. And if that's a nose, then maybe that would be a chin, and that would be, and then it starts to evolve slowly from there. And the real challenge, to be honest, is saying no to all the other things that it wants to be. Telling them, no, next time. After it rains, then it'll be your turn. But today, I need it to be, okay, yes, that's, but you're also negotiating the whole time with what it wants to be. Which is why most of the things I draw are imaginary monsters. Because if you see something that looks like, you know, the nose of a terrier, and if you're determined to draw a terrier, you better hope the rest of it wants to be a terrier, or else people think you don't know how to draw a dog. Which is the problem I've faced many times, where the nose wanted to be a dog, but the tail wanted to be a lizard. And now, what are you going to do? You get to choose, or you just let it be a dog lizard and get on with it.
So this anamorphic technique that you're using, I mean, it's amazing. For those who haven't seen like the videos that David posts on his Instagram and Facebook, from one angle, when you see the artwork, it looks, it's hard to distinguish even what it is sometimes. And then you get to that perfect spot and it looks like you're in a whole nother world. I mean, it looks like it's really popping into your world, actually. And for someone who doesn't do much illustration myself or know too much about it, it looks really hard to draw that way. Is it really hard? And how did you learn how to do that? Because I imagine when you were doing like a poster of Shakespeare on the moon, you weren't having to do that.
Well, actually, I think the process, though, I wouldn't say it's easy. It's made possible by something I failed to learn. Both as a young artist and when I was getting a creative writing degree in college, that it's always about making a lot of mistakes and knowing that you can fix the mistakes and work with the mistakes. When I first noticed people putting these anamorphic drawings on the internet, I thought, I was drawing things that were just flat on the ground and thought, no, I want my friends to actually look like they're there. So I want to do it like that. And the immediate challenge is that after all the work that goes into making a distorted anamorphic drawing, none of these artists wanted to show us what it looked like from the wrong angle. Because they worked so hard. Of course, they don't want you to see it looking all distorted and weird, so they would only show you what it looked like from the right angle, which made it really hard to understand how stretched out and distorted these things really were. Because with a large anamorphic drawing, if you're not standing in the right place, you don't even know what you're looking at. Actually, one of the reasons why I work small, because my drawings are so small, they don't have to stretch as much. And so you'll still know what it is. You just don't get the added bonus of it looking real, unless you know to stand in the right spot. And I'm also a jerk, and I usually don't mark the right spot. So you have to figure that out on your own. But in the meantime, you get to see the little lizard dog. He just looks a little strange. So chalk is very good for making mistakes. Because if you do if the head's too tall or too wide, or if that creature looks a little bit like he's leaning to the left, you smudge it out. Then you draw him in the right place again. And if you fail completely all the way through, you know, spill a cup of water on it, no harm, no foul. So, which is part of the ephemeral. That's the joy of ephemerality right there. That unless you put your name on it, no one's going to know it was you. And it's going to get rained on. So there's no pressure that it actually come out right. And so to whatever degree I have this process figured out, which I don't think I have yet, I'm still working on it. It's because of thousands of drawings that didn't turn out right. But they got progressively better. Yeah.
And you don't put your name next to your illustrations, do you?
No. If you find really old photographs, there are a few where I was yielding to pressure from friends who were afraid that I was going to, you know, have my work stolen by people on the internet, or that I should be more proactive and put my website at the bottom. So you'll find some really old ones like that, but it always felt rude to my imaginary friends that I would write my name on their foot. These creatures are very real to me, and it does not seem polite to claim them. And even beyond that, in a more practical sense, my hope is, and this is a slightly ambitious hope, but my hope is that even maybe for a millisecond, when someone stumbles across one of these drawings in real life, they will not think they are seeing art. Because when you see art, you're usually expecting art. It's, you go to a gallery, you go to a museum, like, oh, here's some art. I will now stand and appreciate the art. And it's all in this very strict framework of art appreciation. if I can sneak these drawings into your regular life where you were not expecting to appreciate art, maybe for a brief second, you do not think you are seeing something that was drawn by anybody at all. You might think this is just a very weird thing that is happening to you today. And maybe it was put there for you to see. And that's not going to happen if the first thing they see is a signature.
Yeah. I love that idea. And then it's also, it's so kind of hard for me to imagine doing that if I was in your shoes, just because where I'm at in my career, right? I'm still like, how do I make a living doing this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so it's like, when I put work out into the world, I want people to know that I did it,
right?
You know? And so, like, I am imagining while I hear you saying that, like, you have hundreds, thousands of people walking by your artwork who love it, mm-hmm. and who could be potential sources of you making a livelihood making fun art.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you still respect the characters enough to say, nope, that's not my place.
Well, and it could be argued that, well, either I'm a very bad role model, or I'm a dangerous case study, because I went against all of my friends' advice and I put my photos up on social media and I didn't watermark them and I didn't try to nail them down or chase them down and make sure no one was using them in a way that wasn't appropriate. And I kept drawing things without my name in the corner. And I am honestly stunned by how often I see an article that someone's written about the things I draw, and they still give me credit for them. They have to do work to even find out that it was me. And it could be argued that there is value in squelching down the amount of ego in a person's art, because it really should be about the art. What I care about most, even beyond making a living off of this, is that the art be enjoyed by somebody. Whether they know it was me is extremely secondary. And I see effects of that even locally, where a lot of people don't know my name, but under the right circumstances, they know I'm the guy that does that thing. Which is still great. When people say, oh, you're the guy that does the things on the that's me. That's the thing I need. And it does seem like, at least in my case, which may be an unusual case, the universe has rewarded me for not pushing to monetize this, for not pushing to take credit for it. And it seems to actually make it even more appreciated, because people can take it for themselves. Sometimes literally. I mean, kindly strangers have brought it to my attention that there are people on Facebook posting my photos and saying it's something they drew in their driveway. Which even then, it's not like it's taking money out of my pocket or food out of my mouth. It's not a smart thing to do these days, because they get caught by a complete stranger who then rap out to me. I don't know why they think they can get away with that in the Google. But still, if it makes them feel more like they're connected to their creative selves, my only hope is they go draw something of their own. Because it's just Crayolas, man. Not a lot of pressure.
Yeah. I love that. So what is your interaction with the public look like when you're drawing? Maybe in the context of them surrounding you and like watching you draw on occasion, or even I'm wondering, after you finish something, do you then go like behind a corner and like peek out and see how people are reacting? Like, what is the interaction with the public look like?
Well, to address the last part first, I've learned very early on that it is better not to hang around. Because you do get kind of full of the experience, because it's usually a deeply gratifying thing to have brought this imaginary thing into the real world. Feels a little bit like a magic trick. And once I walked a few feet away just to put all the chalk back in the box, because there was a bench to sit on. And I got treated to the sight of a man just by pure coincidence, just standing on the face of what I had just drawn to make a cell phone call. Not because he was rude, but because the supposedly magical thing I had just done was so inconsequential to the world at large, he hadn't seen it. Most people were just walking right by. So having had that experience, I've learned that it is much more valuable and certainly more inspiring to have faith. Because I don't know what's going to happen after I walk away. But I can hope. And sometimes I get rewarded that people have told me the story when they do meet me. Like, wow, it's like 3 years ago, I was walking down the street and I was having this really terrible day. And suddenly there was this little creature smiling up at me, and it just completely changed my point of view. So I can just hope and assume that that happens.
Yeah.
And not be determined to prove that it happens. Because when you try to prove that it's happening, then you find out that someone actually spilled a cup of coffee on it after 5 minutes. So better not to be determined to know. Better to assume the best. As far as the earlier parts of the drawing go, I find it very intriguing that there's an arc of ostracization and acceptance in drawing on the sidewalk. Because when you first crouch down on a public street to draw something on the ground, there is no drawing to be seen. Even when you're well into the drawing, anyone 10 feet away can't see the drawing because that's flat on the ground. All they see is a man crouched on the ground for unknown and probably suspicious or unsavory reason. And so even in my hometown, it's a fairly common thing that people will, I think, even unconsciously cross the street to avoid coming too close. Because their brains tell them there's something weird happening here. I don't know what, people don't do that. And so something strange might be going down, and I do not want to get involved, which feels a little bit strange to be voluntarily fighting social norms by crouching like crazy in public. But it's also useful because that's the time during which I really need to be able to communicate with this bunch of specs. And if people were trying to talk to me then, it's I never want to tell them this, but they drown out the voice of the thing I'm trying to create. Because things they'll talk to you, but they talk very quietly. And if someone walks up and says, "Hey, what you doing?" Much harder to know what you're doing in that situation. So early on, there's this sort of crazy hobo stage where everyone's just giving you the polite elbow room. But then once the art is obvious, once it's clear what you're doing, that whole thing boomerangs and people will actually gather and parents will ask if it's okay if their kids just hang out with me while they go down to the post office. So you could not get farther away from that first weird stage of people avoiding you like the plague to people accepting you as a valued member of the community. And every drawing has that cycle to it. So you get to be reminded what it's like to stand on your own, and you get to be reminded what it's like to be embraced all in one.
Wow. So with earlier in the conversation, you talked about the tools you use. You want them to be so simple. And you mentioned that, like, you want kids to be able to see you and feel like, oh, that's what I would use. Mm-hmm. And then you also mentioned that you do workshops for kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in this. In why that is, because one assumption I might have is, like you were saying, everyone starts drawing when they're a kid, they're drawing, but when you're an adult, you just like stop for some reason. Mm-hmm. And so I would think, oh, maybe David would do workshops where he's trying to get adults back into art. And so I'm wondering, yeah, where does this interest in making art feel accessible and fun for kids, like, where does that stem from, and what are you hoping to bring to the world through the work that you do in that way?
Well, to be fair, you are absolutely right. The kids need me less than the adults do. And sometimes it's awkward to have been hired to do a workshop using chalk with kids, because especially under a certain age, the only thing kids want from an adult where art is concerned is for them to hand over the tools and get out of the way. They do not need your help. In fact, it's something I have learned to be wary of when just drawing randomly in public, that children who have just learned how to share, if they see you drawing with chalk on the sidewalk, will run right up to you, take the chalk out of your hand, and fix your drawing for you. Which can be a problem if you've been hired to draw a specific thing. If you're trying to draw an exact duplicate of, you know, the Mona Lisa, and some three-year-old decides the Mona Lisa needs a bright orange mustache, that in itself is a problem. But the instinct is so exactly what we all need. I never have to tell a kid, no making art here. Because that's what we carry into adulthood, is this feeling like, well, no, I shouldn't. No, I'll leave it to the artists. Let the artists make the art. I'm not qualified. So yes, working with the kids is actually a sneaky way to get into the heads of the adults who bring the kids, to see that this is not such a big deal. These are not expensive tools. And see how your kid just knows what decisions to make. And ideally, you end up getting the adults to do it too. Because an adult who tries to object by saying, oh, I wish I could draw, I can only draw stick figures, have not considered what an amazing achievement a stick figure is. If you're drawing on the sidewalk, being able to draw a stick figure puts you above the average talent level of all the drawing on sidewalks. And even if you think about it, it is a circle and what, like five lines, which we all understand is a representation of a human being. That in itself is proof of how awesome art is, that we know that that is a person, even when it's just totally counts. It's a valuable thing to do. And even and especially if these people are not going to quit their jobs and become artists and move into studios and throw paint around, whatever job they are doing is going to be easier and more effectively done if they do draw stick figures, if they do doodle on napkins, if they do access that kid part of their brain that always knows what to do. So a lot of it is just trying to nudge that window of being willing to doodle, make it stronger with a kid, and maybe he will see like, oh, that guy's a grown-up. That guy's a fully grown person who still plays with these chalks, so I guess it's not such a babyish thing to do after all. So maybe when I get to that age, and it's important we get to this age where I'm not so sure about whether I actually need to draw, I'll keep doing it anyway. Because it's a real problem, I think, that as we get older and stop thinking of ourselves as right in everything, which is what toddlers do. It's why toddlers can draw, because they are always right. And if the world disagrees, that's the world's problem. But luckily, as we get older and bigger and stronger, we stop being these, I am always right, tyrants. And we start to think about other people, which is good. You know, it's much healthier as a grown-up to actually care what other people think. But the dark side of caring what other people think is having doubt in your own abilities, in art and in everything else. And as far as I've been able to tell from talking to people, that's why they stop drawing and stop doodling, because we see other people drawing and think, oh, well, I can't do that, so I guess I should stop.
Hmm. Wow. So I mentioned we'd come back to this question on social media and how you're using social media to, well, I don't know what you're using it to do. I guess that's the question. How are you using social media? Is it a key element in you being able to make a living doing this thing? What role does it play for you?
Okay, if I wanted to sound smart, I would lie and claim that this was the plan all along. that by putting your artwork up on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and Tumblr and everything else, knowing that it's very easy to share a JPEG in a matter of seconds, that it would spread my art all over a global audience. And eventually, if you get in front of the eyeballs of enough people, 1 out of 1,000 is going to think, hey, I should hire that guy. And then, ta-da, you have a thriving career. Yeah, that wasn't my plan. The only reason that I started even taking photographs of the stuff I was drawing is because I only have one brother and he lives 500 miles away on the East Coast. And we both like to draw. And I wanted him to see the stuff I was drawing, but I wasn't going to be so aggressive as a little brother as to send him a picture and say, look at what I drew. And I think this is a thing a lot of us use social media for this in various ways. And we don't really acknowledge the miracle of this, that social media has solved a lot of the headaches of sharing that we used to have before the internet. It used to be true that if you had kids, if you were a parent and you had cute kids and you wanted people to see pictures of your cute kids, you had to carry physical photographs of your children in your pocket and then wait for opportunities and conversations with other people where it was socially acceptable to pull out pictures of your kids, which they then had to look at while you were looking at them to see what they thought about your cute kids. It was horrible. It's a terrible thing we had to do. Same was true of going on vacation. People would actually set aside an evening to go to someone's house and sit in front of a slide projector and look at photographs of where people went on vacation for hours. And you hear enough jokes about it that clearly it wasn't all that much fun. It was a duty that we did because when we went on vacation, we wanted them to come suffer through our vacation photos. It was a terrible system. And now we have this great new thing where if you want people to see a picture of that great vacation you went on, you don't have to show it to them at all. You just, I'm just going to put this here on my wall. Maybe you look, maybe you don't. Maybe you like it, maybe you hate it. The beautiful thing about it is when you respond to that vacation photo or that kid's picture, you can like it or hate it out loud in the privacy of your own home. And no one's going to find out that you didn't think that kid was all that cute. And that's exactly what I started doing with my art, because I wanted my brother to see it. I didn't necessarily want him to feel pressured to say he liked it, because then I would be shattered because he's my older brother and I respect him so much. So instead, I just happened to put it on my wall and he happened to see it. And I don't know if he liked it or not, but I fooled him early on into thinking that there was a missing brick in a wall that didn't have any missing bricks. And so that winning a gold star for all eternity, because I fooled my own brother with a thing that I drew on a brick wall. It was awesome.
So now, as you're saying, so lots of people see your work. Mm-hmm. Someone sees it and says, oh, that's really cool. I want to hire him. So are people hiring you to go do sidewalk art in their, like, what are you getting hired for?
Yeah, it's a logical question. Not the first time I've gotten the question of like, so how do you make a living off this? Sometimes I just tell them I try not to think about it too carefully because I agree it doesn't make sense. But
well, not thinking about things too carefully seems right. to be like a good strategy. Well, like, seriously,
so well
like for, you are.
Yeah.
Right. Like you're tuning in this. I mean, that's one of the things I've gotten throughout this conversation. Like you're really tuning in to like what matters most about your artwork, about who you are as a person. And because you're staying so true to that, like the world presents you with opportunities. So I don't think that's anything to be like, you know, dismissive about for
well,
sure.
It's a little scary. It feels sometimes like you had one of those weird fairy tale cradle moments where a little fairy godmother came and went bling and said, everyone will love his drawings, no matter silly or stupid. And then if you offend that fairy godmother, it's all going to go away. So I think that's where the nervousness comes from. But it's very similar to when I was a commercial artist, that there are people who want a guy who likes to draw. It's just that now it's summer camps where they want a way to keep kids busy outside for an afternoon. And it's really easy to get a hold of a box of chalk. It's bittersweet, actually, that I do a lot of stuff in schools, because a lot of elementary schools and middle schools now don't have an art teacher. They have just enough budget to bring in artists for a day to do some art stuff. And I think that's tragic, and even more tragic that I'm a beneficiary of that, because people can afford to bring me in for a day just to draw with kids. I go to festivals and draw at festivals, although I found that I tend to fit in strangely with actual chalk art festivals, because people who create chalk art at festivals tend to be really good at drawing pictures of planned stuff. In fact, that's what they're best at. That's how chalk art started, was being able to duplicate things. So before cameras and before wide-ranging travel, if you wanted to see the Mona Lisa and you didn't live in the town where the Mona Lisa was, your only hope of seeing the Mona Lisa was for some guy who'd seen it to come to your town and draw it for you. Usually with chalk on a flagstone somewhere. And so they tend to like take a square and they draw something they planned out carefully in advance, usually some famous painting they're recreating in that square. And I'm terrible at that. That's all kinds of thinking and planning and knowing what you're doing. And that's, as we've observed, not my forte. But I have gone to other types of festivals just to draw on the street. I've even done some permanent pieces, as terrifying as that was, that are hidden in towns all over the world, to be scavenger hunt versions of art, where it's a mural. I guess you'd call it a micro mural because it's on a wall somewhere, but it's only 6 inches high.
All right, so we're almost out of time for the main show. I have a couple last questions here. And the first one of those is, you mentioned how you walk away from your art after you've made it on the sidewalk. You're not sitting there watching how people interact with it. And you kind of have faith. What is that? Like, how would you describe what that faith is? Like, what do you have faith in? And I think this gets at like the impact that you want it to have in the world. Where is your faith lie?
My faith lies in the unpredictability of interconnectedness, that we may think we know what and who we're going to come in contact with today, but we really don't. And in fact, most of our lives are determined by accidental crossings of things. And when we look back on it, it all looks very well planned. But in truth, it was just stuff happening one thing after another. And I guess the faith is having an optimistic view of that. That because I leave my art behind and have no control over it and no ownership of it after I walk away, the possibilities of the impact it could have are enormous. As long as I don't need proof, as long as I don't need certainty, there's a slim chance that if you follow enough connections from person to person to person, it's not inconceivable that a silly drawing I do on Main Street tomorrow might indirectly help cure cancer. Because it might be seen by a guy who is working with a guy who works in a lab downtown, who has been struggling with a problem that he wasn't able to fix. And then for some reason, because he saw this weird thing on the sidewalk, it makes him think about this thing he's working on in a different way. Maybe even just because the shapes were similar, or because it cheered him up, or because it made him angry. And he was so angry, he wanted to smash something. Then he smashed a thing, and smashing that turned out to fix the problem with what he was doing. And he didn't even expect that. So you see, it's a bold claim to make, but if you consider how infinite that progression is, how much of a ripple effect we all have on everybody in the world, whether we're making art or saying hello on the street, you have faith that eventually it's going to make a beneficial impact somewhere.
Faith and serendipity.
Yeah, very much.
I love that. Yeah. All right. Well, before we wrap up with a final question, David, if people want to check out your work and check you out on the social media we've been referencing, where are we sending them?
Well, I do have a website, which is the shortest thing to explain because it's just zinart.com, ZINNART. But it's much easier to put things on social media. So for actually seeing the thing I drew 2 days ago, they'll want to go to Facebook, where I have a professional Facebook page, David Zinn Illustration. Instagram is just David Zinn with no space. Twitter is David Zinn _art. The only trick of trying to find my work is that there is a very famous David Zinn who's won Tony Awards.
I saw that when I was looking at stuff.
Because I used to work in the theater, even people who know me often think I'm that David Zinn. And it's always awkward to tell them that, no, I've not won a Tony Award for SpongeBob SquarePants on Broadway. But it's useful and humbling to have another person with your name who will probably always be more famous than you. And I hope that at least one person has asked him about his chalk art. So at least.
All right. So let's wrap up with this. You strike me. We've talked a lot about you tuning into your own kind of creative pathways and mind. And I'm sure there are some people out there listening right now who are at creative roadblocks of their own or finding their voice as a creative. Like I consider myself in that place as well. And how would you suggest, or what advice would you give to them to help them unlock their personal creativity?
Yeah, that's tricky. Well, part of what I think is even contained in the way that I do my art that would apply to this is that we tend to have an unnecessary wall between art and life, which is why I put my art on streets and sidewalks instead of in museums and galleries, because the stuff that's happening in your life is unavoidably part of your art and part of your creativity. In fact, thinking about it recently, that someone mentioned that phrase, like, write what you know. When I stopped and thought about it, that's kind of an inane, at least, phrasing for that idea, because you can only write what you know. You don't really have the option of writing anything else. I think a better phrasing for it would be, don't write anything you don't know. But what you know is entirely open to your own whims and passions. And I worry there's a lot of people who are frustrated with the kind of art that they think they're supposed to make, while not realizing that they have a thing that they really deeply care about. They just don't think of it as art. And they don't think of it as even being connected to their art. When, in fact, just like the faith in serendipity, there are connections everywhere. You can't even get away from it. But even, you know, having a good day with your kids is going to impact your creative self. I was listening to a podcast of yours, I believe, with the fellow who wrote Froggy Gets Dressed. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And what struck me, among many cool things in that podcast, is, you know, his first story was entertaining his kids in the car. He didn't sit down and say, I am now going to be a world famous author. I'm going to write a fantastic kid story. No, he was under pressure to entertain his children on the spot. That's what was in his mind. I think, as far as I've been able to tell, the best way to make art is to not be trying to make art. That's why I was happy being a commercial artist doing Shakespeare on the Moon. That's why I'm happy just having an excuse to be outside. At no point is it about the making of art. It's about just enjoying what is available in that moment. Now, there is a really good, if you have time for it, as this might be useful as the bonus thing. I don't feel like I answered that question very well when it's phrased so directly, because I'm worried about giving bad advice. But there is a fantastic quote by Martha Graham that I think addresses this perfectly, especially since, even though it was a dancer giving advice to a dancer, it doesn't specify the type of art involved at all. And I think it applies really well to both the respect that you need for your undeniably unique point of view, which we all have, and the necessity of embracing the dissatisfaction of it. Because the main thing I've noticed in people who have given up on making art, and I run into a lot of them because of the whole, like, oh, I wish I could draw kind of thing, is they assume that artists are always satisfied with what they've made. They think, oh, I must not be an artist because I drew a thing and I didn't like it. And my thought, which I try not to share with them at the time, is, well, welcome to the club. If I was ever completely happy with something that I drew, I would never draw again. Why would I mess with that? If it was the perfect thing that I could ever draw, the next thing I draw is either going to be that again or something worse. And it's that little bit of disappointment, like, oh, that didn't come out right. But the next one, that will be better. And we all walk around making art in this way, hopefully, and being in quiet, pleasant denial of the fact that we're never going to be completely happy. Because that's not the point. The point is to be making the art. That's what I'd advise. And I took the time to print out the quote because I didn't want to bungle it. So if you want, too long for a bumper sticker or a t-shirt, so I don't think people see it very often. But it is a good Martha Graham quote if you want it.
Well, let's hear it.
All right. Okay. I put the iPad on top of it in my haste, so that doesn't mess anything up. All right. This is what she told to a struggling artist a long time ago. There is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all of time, this expression is unique. If you block it, it will never exist through any other medium, and it will be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours, clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You do not even have to believe in yourself or your work. You have to keep yourself open and aware to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. No artist is pleased. There is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the others.
Mm.
Blessed unrest.
I was literally just writing down those two words, blessed unrest. Ugh.
Yeah,
that so
gets
well.
Me because I know that feeling. It's that exact. It's a much better phrasing of what I was just talking about. There's this feeling of, I wish it had been. Oh, but maybe, yeah. Well, it could still could.
So yep.
I'm gonna do another one because maybe the next one. And it's just this constant march of the anticipation of what's going to go right next time. What's going to go right after that one.
Blessed unrest.
Yeah.
Wow, that's beautiful. All right. Well, that wraps up the main show here with David Zinn. And he's going to stick around for about 10 minutes or so. He's been very generous with his time. We're going to ask him in the post show some fun questions like what city outside of Michigan has been his favorite canvas for street art. And so if you want to hear his answers to that question and some other ones, you can get access to the private podcast and the post show by subscribing to Austin Meyer Films on Patreon. So that's patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. And for as little as $2 a month, you can get access to all the post shows with our guests and also some additional episodes that I record. So go check that out if you want to hear it. David some more. But David, thank you so much for joining the show today. I learned a ton, and this was such a pleasure.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks.
That's it for episode 22 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you to David Zinn for being on the show. I had so much fun getting the opportunity to speak with him. The fact that his little chalk monsters are out there in the world at this very moment, and the fact that he can make a living creating them, that just makes me so happy. At one point in the interview, David mentioned that at times he's felt a little self-conscious or a little guilty about not doing something that feels more altruistic, like curing cancer, I think was the example he used. But to me, creating art that makes people more present, that delights, that just adds more smiles to the world, I believe that is an incredibly noble pursuit, and I'm so glad that he's out there doing it. If you want to hear the post show with David, where I ask him some additional fun questions that we didn't have time to get to in the main show, like this one right here, what are your thoughts on Banksy?
I will always be very impressed and intimidated by the gap between my own art and what Banksy does, because...
So if you want to hear David's response to that question, and a bunch of other fun ones, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. For as little as $2 a month, you can help support the show and get access to all the post shows with our guests and additional episodes on the craft of storytelling. Shout out to all the patrons so far. I really appreciate your support. That's all from me today. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, go out and tell some stories.